Good afternoon. Welcome to the 417th meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations, both to our members and guests who are here today and to our public radio audience reaching us through the stations of Maine Public Radio. Today's meeting comes to you from Point Lookout Conference Center in Northport, Maine. I'm George Look, president of the Forum. The Forum was founded in 1983 to promote study and discussion of the development, formulation, and implementation of U.S. foreign policies. We are now in our 35th year of monthly meetings, featuring prominent speakers covering all aspects of U.S. foreign policy. Details about past and upcoming forum programs are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. For our meeting today, we're very pleased to have with us Dr. Gary Seymour, who will be speaking on Love and Fury, Trump Takes on North Korea and Iran. Dr. Seymour is professor of practice of politics at Brandeis University and senior executive director of the Brandeis University Crown Center for Middle East Studies. He is also a senior fellow at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard, where he previously served as executive director for research. Dr. Seymour was President Obama's White House Coordinator for Arms Control and Weapons of Mass Destruction from 2009 to 2013, and Senior Director for Nonproliferation and Export Controls for President Clinton from 1996 to 2001. He has also worked at the Department of State, the Council on Foreign Relations, the International Institute for Strategic Studies in London, and the MacArthur Foundation. Dr. Seymour has a PhD in government from Harvard University, where he graduated with the PhD in 1984. Gary, a warm welcome to the Midcoast Forum.
Thanks very much, George, and thanks to the Forum, and thank all of you for coming to listen to me. George is being far too modest. He has a long way to go before he runs out of people he knows in Washington to come up and speak, and I'll certainly tell him that it's a great opportunity that shouldn't be missed, especially when the weather's nice. So as George said, my topic is Love and Fury, President Trump's efforts to deal with the nuclear challenge from Iran and North Korea. And in both cases, we have a very long history of U.S. efforts to prevent Iran and North Korea from acquiring nuclear weapons. And I think it's important to keep that in mind before we evaluate the Trump administration's efforts to deal with these same threats. And if you look over U.S. policy, which in the case of Iran really dates back to the Ford administration, and then the case of North Korea dates back to the Reagan administration, the results of U.S. policy are clear. In the case of Iran, we've succeeded so far in preventing Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons, even though Iran has crept closer to mastering the basic technologies for producing nuclear weapons. Since they acquired enrichment technology and nuclear weapons designs from Pakistan in the early 1980s. In fact, I'm convinced that Iran would have nuclear weapons today if it weren't for the efforts of the U.S. and its allies over the decades, including political pressure, economic sanctions, sabotage, export controls, and of course diplomacy, which culminated in the 2015 nuclear agreement called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, which I'll talk about. In the case of North Korea, in contrast, U.S. policy has clearly failed. North Korea's, we use the same policy tools that we did with Iran, diplomacy, economic sanctions, military threats, political pressure, and I think we helped to slow down North Korea's program through a series of agreements that limited or froze temporarily North Korean nuclear activities. But at the end of the day, North Korea was unstoppable. North Korea's had nuclear weapons for at least 10 years. since they first conducted a nuclear test in 2006. And more recently, last year, North Korea tested a thermonuclear device, a hydrogen bomb, and long-range missiles, which in theory are capable of reaching the United States. So what explains this difference? We use the same policy tools, but the results have been dramatically different. I think the reasons really lie in underlying structural factors that are independent of any particular president and his administration's policies in terms of the motivations and the capabilities of North Korea versus Iran, and the efficacy of the policy tools that the U.S. can bring to bear in dealing with those challenges. Basically, Pyongyang has been highly determined and dedicated to acquiring nuclear weapons as a matter of national survival. And the power of U.S. incentives and pressures have been relatively limited by the dictatorial nature of the North Korean regime, its isolated economy, protection from China, which has always valued stability over non-proliferation, and by the vulnerability of U.S. regional allies to any counterattack if we were to actually use military force against North Korea's nuclear and missile installations. In contrast, Iran's motivations have been much more episodic and ambivalent. And U.S. policy tools have enjoyed much better intelligence, more credible military threats, with full encouragement from our regional allies, and more powerful political and economic tools because the Iranian economy is much more susceptible to international sanctions and the regime is much more susceptible to domestic political pressures. So with these differences in mind, let me turn to President Trump's policy, starting with Iran, which I call a bigger and better deal. As you all know, President Trump inherited President Obama's 2015 nuclear agreement with Iran, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which basically imposes physical limits on Iran's ability to produce fissile material for nuclear weapons for 10 to 15 years through constraints on the number and type of centrifuges, on the size of its stockpile of low-enriched uranium, on its enrichment levels, as well as enhanced monitoring techniques. So the JCPOA did not solve the Iranian nuclear threat. It postponed it for 10 to 15 years, kicked the can down the road, which is what we often do when we're faced with intractable diplomatic problems. In exchange for the constraints that Iran accepted on its nuclear program, the parties to the agreement, the U.S., Russia, China, U.K., France, and Germany, committed to suspend and eventually to remove international sanctions against Iran. From the beginning, President Trump said that the JCPOA was a horrible deal and that he could negotiate a better one. So on May 8th, President Trump announced that he was withdrawing the U.S. from the JCPOA, and he began to reimpose the U.S. sanctions that had been lifted under the agreement. And just last week, the Trump administration completed the process of reimposing sanctions by applying the most significant remaining sanctions on Iran's energy exports, its shipping industry, and its financial sector, with the explicit objective of driving Iran's oil exports to zero and cutting Iran off from international transactions in U.S. dollars, which, of course, is the main currency of international commerce. The purpose of this U.S. strategy is to inflict regime-threatening, crippling economic punishment to force Tehran back to the bargaining table to accept a bigger and better deal. And on May 21st, Secretary of State Pompeo gave a speech which outlined the terms of such a bigger and better deal. The U.S. would require Iran to accept much more stringent limits on its nuclear program and missile program. including a halt to research and development on advanced centrifuges, a removal of the sunset clauses, so the limits would keep in place in perpetuity, wouldn't be lifted after 10 to 15 years. It would limit ballistic missile development and testing, and we would require Iran to change its regional behavior, for example, its support for Hezbollah and Hamas. And in return, Secretary of State Pompeo said the U.S. would be willing to lift the primary U.S. economic sanctions against Iran and establish normal diplomatic relations. Now, there's no doubt that the U.S. has been able to inflict very substantial economic damage on Iran since we withdrew from the JCPOA in May. Scores of private companies, mainly European, have already withdrawn from trade and investment in Iran out of fear of facing U.S. secondary sanctions if they continue to do business with Iran. So the Iranian currency, the rial, has lost about 50% of its value, and inflation is rising, including on very basic food items. The World Bank estimates that that in 2018 and 19, inflation will be about 25% and then raised to about 30% in the following year, 2019-20. And most important, Iranian oil exports have dropped from about 3 million barrels a day over the summer to about 1.5 million barrels a day last month. So they've been cut about in half. And the International Monetary Fund has forecast that Iran's economy will contract by about 1.5% this year and about almost 4% next year. And this has resulted in some genuine public discontent in Iran, protests about the price of onions and other important commodities, and people upset over job losses and inflations and so forth. But so far, this economic pressure hasn't been sufficient to force Iran back to the bargaining table. Instead, Tehran has rejected U.S. offers to negotiate unless the U.S. returns to compliance with the JCPOA, which, of course, is not going to happen. In the meantime, Iran continues to comply with the nuclear constraints in the nuclear agreement as monitored by the International Atomic Energy Agency. And the Iranians are trying to work with the other parties to the agreement, all of which have pledged to try to salvage and protect the nuclear agreement in order to mitigate sanctions. I think this Iranian strategy is based on three factors. First, the Iranian leadership simply doesn't believe that the Trump administration is serious about negotiating a new agreement that would be minimally acceptable to Iran. In their view, the demands that Secretary of State Pompeo laid out are so extreme that the talks are doomed to fail, and in Iran's view, this diplomatic initiative is really just a cover for a regime change strategy. Second, Tehran calculates that the international oil market won't allow the Trump administration to force all of Iran's oil exports off the market without triggering steep price increases. And already last week, Washington had to grant exemptions to Iran's primary oil customers, which are mainly in Asia, China, Russia, South Korea, and Japan, and to allow them to continue to purchase Iranian oil at reduced rates for another 6 months, for 180 days. Washington says that this is a one-time exemption and that it won't grant additional ones, but it's very unclear that there will be sufficient additional oil supply, which mainly has to come from Saudi Arabia and Russia, to make up for the 1.5 million barrels a day that Iran is exporting. And finally, Tehran believes that poor diplomatic relations between Washington and the other main countries, whether it's animosity with Europe or trade war with China, sanctions against Russia, disagreement with Turkey over Syria, and even tensions with Saudi over the Yemen conflict, and the Khashoggi murder, will really undermine Washington's efforts to effectively enforce sanctions and create opportunities for the Iranians to evade sanctions through smuggling and other activities. And the Iranian government, of course, has been under international sanctions for decades, so they've perfected a lot of techniques for smuggling. So basically, the Iranian strategy is to hunker down, to try to weather the storm in hopes that President Trump will not be reelected in 2020, and the new U.S. administration will be prepared to negotiate a return to the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, with some modifications. Nobody thinks the deal can be restored in its previous state. There'll have to be some adjustments on both sides, and that could be a very tough negotiation, not at all guaranteed to be successful. So let me now turn to North Korea, which I subtitled, "You Always Hurt the One You Love." So you'll remember that President Trump came into office facing a very aggressive North Korea nuclear and missile testing program, which actually began in the last year of President Obama's administration. And President Trump responded by working with China to impose additional UN sanctions under the banner of maximum pressure. President Trump engaged in personal insults against North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, calling him Little Rocket Man. And most seriously, he threatened to inflict a bloody-nose military strike if North Korea continued to develop missiles that could hit the United States. So under those circumstances of increasing tensions, I was very relieved that President Trump switched to high-stakes summitry with Kim Jong-un in an effort to reduce the risk of war and jumpstart a diplomatic process. And I think in that respect, the Singapore summit on June 12th was successful, even though some of the execution was flawed. For example, President Trump agreed to a suspension of joint US-ROK military exercises on the spot without notifying either our South Korean allies or the Pentagon. So the execution was not very graceful, but the overall objective of the summit was achieved. But at the same time, I thought it was very foolish for President Trump to oversell the results of the Singapore summit and to create the expectation that Kim Jong-un would actually give up his nuclear weapons and his missile arsenal. So it was no surprise that the high expectations of the Singapore summit crashed into hard reality when Secretary of State Pompeo subsequently met with his counterpart, Vice Chairman Kim Yong-chol, for meetings in Pyongyang in July. And then when Secretary Pompeo went back to Pyongyang for meetings with Kim Jong-un in September to arrange for the second Trump-Kim summit, and very little progress was made. And last week, we know Kim Yong-chol canceled his scheduled meeting with Pompeo in New York, I think in part because there was just very little prospect for making much progress. And the reason for that is because Washington and Pyongyang have fundamentally different views toward how to achieve denuclearization. Washington wants Pyongyang to take significant steps toward disarmament up front before it receives any substantial benefit, whereas Pyongyang says it needs significant reassurances up front before it has the confidence to give up its nuclear weapons. In essence, we say to the North Koreans, we will be nice to you if you give up your nuclear weapons. And the North Koreans say, if you're nice to us, then we can give up our nuclear weapons. And in particular, Pyongyang is looking for early sanctions relief in exchange for partial steps toward denuclearization. So, for example, Kim Jong-un has publicly said he'd be willing to dismantle nuclear facilities at their old nuclear center, the Yongbyon Nuclear Center, which at one time was the main nuclear installation. Not anymore, but at one time it was, well, it was where the program started. Kim Jong-un is saying, I will destroy this old facility, which is frankly obsolete, if you give me, in return, sanctions benefit and economic benefit. Washington, however, is saying we're not going to give you any economic benefit at all until you've completed or at least made very, very substantial progress toward complete denuclearization. And that means not just the obsolete facilities that Kim Jong-un has destroyed unilaterally or has offered to destroy, but the newer facilities. And you probably, some of you saw the story in the New York Times about North Korea that was in the paper today. North Korea continues to build facilities for both nuclear weapons production and for the deployment of their missile arsenal. So the immediate sticking point is the conditions and timing for a second Trump-Kim summit. To avoid presidential improvisation at the summit, Washington wants to negotiate an agreement beforehand, which the leaders can then announce, including a full DPRK declaration of its nuclear facilities and inventory in exchange for a U.S. declaration ending the Korean War. For its part, Pyongyang prefers leaving issues unresolved so that they can be discussed and settled at the summit itself, because they view President Trump as much more flexible than his administration. With respect to timing, President Trump doesn't really seem to be in a hurry. He's already declared victory. He boasts that the nuclear and missile tests have halted, U.S. hostages have been freed, remains of U.S. soldiers missing in action from the Korean War have been returned, and it's not clear that there's much additional political benefit for President Trump from having further meetings with Kim Jong-un. Kim Jong-un, on the other hand, seems to be pressing for an early summit, complaining that the U.S. has not delivered on promises that President Trump made to him in Singapore. The great concern in Seoul is that President Trump has lost interest in his love affair with Kim, and that Kim, feeling scorned, will unleash his fury with a new round of nuclear and missile tests. In fact, last week, the North Korean Foreign Ministry hinted that they would reconsider their policy of nuclear restraint if sanctions relief is not forthcoming soon. Despite these threats, however, I doubt that the U.S. DPRK negotiations are on the verge of collapse. Even though Kim Jong-un has not reaped as much economic benefit as he hoped for, especially in the form of generous trade and investments from South Korea, much of the economic pressure on North Korea has been relieved as China and Russia have gradually relaxed enforcement of sanctions after the Singapore summit meeting. And all of this de facto sanctions relief could be jeopardized if Kim Jong-un resumes nuclear and missile testing. At the same time, I think the Trump administration would be prudent to modify its current demand for complete denuclearization before granting sanctions relief. To keep the process moving forward, for example, the U.S. could offer limited economic benefits to North Korea in exchange for partial denuclearization, such as suspending some of the U.S. sanctions if North Korea accepts a freeze on production of additional fissile material, including the undeclared facilities, which North Korea has never acknowledged. Of course, this approach is not going to achieve the administration's stated objective of complete denuclearization by the end of 2020, but of course, that was never a realistic goal in any event. So in conclusion, I think the situation at the end of President Trump's first term will be basically the same as it is now. North Korea will have nuclear weapons and Iran won't. The Trump administration is not going to be able to force Iran to accept a bigger and better deal, not in the next 2 years, but Iran seems likely to continue to comply with the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action for the time being. They may recalculate their position after the U.S. elections, but for now, we're in the ironic situation of still enjoying the benefits of nuclear constraints on Iran's program, even at the same time that we sanction them. I think that is likely to continue through 2020. But even if Iran decides to withdraw from the nuclear agreement, I think they will revive their nuclear program in a very cautious and gradual way to avoid provoking a military attack. That's always been Iran's history, is great caution in their pursuit of nuclear weapons. With respect to North Korea, the Singapore summit succeeded in securing a test moratorium, which has some important technical value, and beginning a long-term USDPRK negotiation process. Now, obviously, this process is not going to eliminate North Korea's nuclear weapons and ballistic missiles anytime soon, but if the Trump administration is capable of clever and creative diplomacy, it might achieve some additional limits on North Korea's nuclear program, such as a freeze on further production of fissile material. So whoever is elected president in 2020 and takes office in January 2021, I'm afraid he or she will face the same nettlesome nuclear challenges from North Korea and Iran that presidents, that the, at least the last six presidents, have faced. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Gary. It gives us a lot to think about. I'm going to take the prerogative I always do as the moderator and ask a couple of a question or two while we're getting the written questions up here at the podium. You seem to have not talked very much about the other parties to the JCPOA, to the Iranian deal. Are they going to be able to sustain this agreement? I mean, in light of U.S. sanctions and us applying sanctions to them, to their banking systems, et cetera?
So it's a really great question. And the I think if you look at the other parties, you have to rank them. I think the European governments are the least able to protect the agreement, mainly because in Europe, private businesses make their own calculations based on cost-benefit analysis, and in particular, all of the big European companies that did business in Iran after the nuclear agreement also have huge stakes in access to the U.S. market. So for them, it's a simple calculation to protect themselves from U.S. secondary sanctions by cutting off their business with Iran. So the European governments don't like it, and they've talked about setting up a special channel to finance business between European companies and Iran without using the dollar, to try to circumvent the dollar. But it's not clear that that's going to sustain, that that's going to sustain very substantial business activities, because, again, big European companies will not want to take the risk of using that channel and then being excluded from the European market. I do think we'll see the emergence of small European companies that are set up with the specific purpose of doing business with Iran and that have no financial interest in access to the U.S. market. And these will be sort of bespoke legal entities which are created for the purpose of doing business with Iran, and they won't care whether they're subject to secondary U.S. sanctions. In the case of Russia and China, I think it's obviously they're much more able, in part because of poor, you know, relations between Washington and Moscow, and you know, as well as Beijing. They're much more able to confront and stand up to U.S. sanctions, especially because many of the companies there are not purely private. They're very closely associated with the government, and therefore they will, you know, are in a position where they have to do what the government says. I think the, you know, the Iranians are counting on U.S. relations in Russia and China to remain very bad, and therefore giving Iran opportunities to exploit those tensions. The nightmare in Tehran is that Trump will settle his economic disputes with China and lift sanctions against Russia. And if that happens, the Iranians might very well change their calculation, because they, right now, they're feeling pretty comfortable that the U.S. is isolated and Iran is able to exploit all the tensions between the U.S. and the other big powers. But if the Trump administration really wants to put pressure on Iran, then Trump should try to find a way to settle his trade disputes with China and, if possible, resolve the conflicts with Russia and try to lift some of the sanctions.
Thank you. There's a couple of questions here on the status of the JPCOA, the Iran agreement. Was it ratified by the Senate? Is it a treaty, or what type of agreement was it?
So the JCPOA was not a treaty, and it was deliberately not a treaty because the Obama administration knew they could never get two-thirds of the Senate to ratify that agreement. And the Obama administration, like other administrations, faced with the very high constitutional hurdle of ratification for international treaties, have developed a whole body of what are essentially executive agreements or political understandings that circumvent the requirement for Senate confirmation. These are not just Democratic administrations. Republican administrations have done the same thing. And I think that's one of the people talk about the strength of the imperial presidency in foreign policy. And going back, I don't know how far, but a long way, you know, to probably World War I, presidents have developed ways to achieve international agreements without requiring Senate ratification, because it's almost impossible to get a treaty ratified in the Senate, since it requires two-thirds votes. George and I worked on the ratification of the New START Treaty, and even though it was, I think, a pretty modest treaty and in many ways very much in U.S. interest, it was difficult. There was a fair amount of Republican opposition, and without a number of Republicans being willing, senators being willing to break ranks with the leadership and vote their conscience, because at the time the majority leader said that he would not require a party vote. He would allow senators to vote whatever their views were. Without that, we never would have gotten New START ratified.
It's a question, and just a general question, of how the U.S. government works, but in particular in the Trump administration and on Iran. Could you comment on the process by which the Trump administration arrives at its Iranian policies?
So, I mean, I think Iran is a very good example of, well, both really are a very good example of President Trump's distinctive style in diplomacy, which, and I think he is probably brings this from his business career, and he's talked about this in his book, The Art of the Deal, right? You always start the negotiations by unsettling the other side through threats and insults and disruptive actions. And then when you soften them up, that's when you try to make a deal. And whatever deal you make, whatever the merits, it's the best deal in the world. Right? So that's the Trump style. And I think we've seen that both in the case of Iran and North Korea. It's been more successful in the case of North Korea because for the North Koreans, having a meeting with President Trump was a great, something they have been trying to get for the last two presidents. In the case of Iran, it's meeting with an American president is much more politically radioactive, and especially a president who's insulted the Iranians. They're extremely thin-skinned when it comes to their pride, and I think it was it's not well known, but the Trump administration tried to set up a meeting between President Trump and President Rouhani in the first September of Trump's term, when Rouhani was in New York for the UN General Assembly. And apparently it was quite an effort on the part of the U.S. to organize a meeting between Trump and Rouhani. If that had happened, it makes me wonder whether Trump would have withdrawn from the nuclear deal. He might have left the meeting saying that Rouhani's a great guy, he's got a terrific sense of humor, you know, we can do a deal together. But the Iranians just couldn't bring themselves to overcome what they saw as Trump's offensive behavior and suspicion about his motives. Whereas Kim Jong-un, the North Koreans are very comfortable insulting people back and forth. It doesn't bother them very much. And when Trump accepted Kim Jong-un's offer to meet, they were just elated. And from North Korea's standpoint, the outcome of the Singapore meeting, as I said, was more than they possibly imagined. And their disappointment has been in follow-up. But in terms of how decisions are made, in the case of Iran, we know that President Trump's decision to withdraw the U.S. from the agreement was very controversial. And I think opposition to that decision from both his first Secretary of State, Tillerson, and his first National Security Advisor, McMaster, was one of the main reasons why President Trump became disillusioned with them and probably really contributed to their departure from the administration. So the Trump decision to leave the Iran agreement was very, very controversial, especially among most people in the government who pursued follow this issue. And according to the rumor in Washington, John Bolton has really been given the lead on the Iran portfolio. In the case of North Korea, it's clearly Pompeo who's been given the lead in terms of trying to actually carry out the decisions or the announcements that were made in the Singapore meeting. And by all accounts, Secretary Pompeo has become very skeptical that North Korea is serious about denuclearization. I don't know how much of that he's communicated to President Trump. I think with Trump, what he says in public is not, you can't count on that being a reflection of his real views. So even though he says everything's going great with North Korea, I hear from some people that he now realizes that the North Koreans have certainly not behaved in a way since the Singapore meeting that would lead you to believe that they're genuine about giving up their nuclear weapons. And that may be another reason why he's not highly motivated to have more meetings with Kim Jong-un. But the decision-making in the Trump administration is highly personalized and doesn't appear to be very bureaucratic. In most administrations, there's a whole bureaucratic structure for considering options and people at lower levels who are normally experts in these decisions meet and make recommendations to the deputies, and they meet and make reputations and make recommendations to the principals, and then they make recommendations to the president. So it's very cumbersome but a very systematic process. Doesn't appear to be the case in the Trump administration. It appears to be much more, President Trump makes a decision on his own or in talking to just a couple of people, and the bureaucracy finds out afterwards.
While we're on Iran, there are a number of questions related to the extent to which the other players in the region influence our policies. For example, to what extent is our enmity toward Iran due to Saudi influence? Have we been dragged into the Sunni-Shia religious war? Let me read a couple of them. They're the same type of theme. Is the apparent Israeli-Saudi alliance against Iran threatened by responses to the murder of the Saudi columnist and analyst in Turkey? Or will Iran react with increased sanctions by engaging in more provocative behavior in the region? Just to what extent do the regional influences play in all of this?
So those are all great questions. And there's no doubt that our principal allies in the Middle East, Israel and Saudi Arabia, are very much in favor of President Trump's hard line toward Iran. And in fact, both of them think it's not hard enough. They would like us to attack Iran. I mean, that's their, for them, the solution to the Iranian threat is a U.S. bombing campaign. I don't think President Trump's particularly interested in getting into another major war in the Middle East. I think he probably is sincere when he says his focus is on the U.S. domestic economy. And as you all know, he's been very critical of U.S. military adventures in the Middle East. In that respect, he's similar to Obama, who saw his job as keeping us out of war rather than continuing the conflicts that President Bush started in both Iraq and Afghanistan. But so there's no doubt that at least some of the Trump administration's policy toward Iran has been dictated by a deliberate effort to be closer to Israel and Saudi Arabia and work with them against Iran's influence in the region, which is a very dramatic shift from the Obama administration's policies, where we pursued the nuclear deal even against the opposition of Israel and Saudi Arabia. In terms of the Iran's regional behavior, I've always thought that the Iranians are really skillful at taking advantage of opportunities that are presented to them. So they capitalized on the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq to really consolidate a very strong political position in Baghdad. So no Iranian government, no government in Iraq can afford to take an openly hostile position to Iran, because so many of the political parties, especially the Shia political parties inside Iraq, are heavily influenced by Iran's behavior. So from Iran's standpoint, the removal of their biggest regional enemy, Saddam Hussein, and replacement by a weak government in Baghdad that is heavily susceptible to the Iranian influence, this was a tremendous accomplishment, and of course, courtesy of the United States. And the Iranians also have been very skillful in taking advantage of the civil wars that broke out in Arab countries as a consequence of the Arab Spring. So the Iranian position in Syria is because they made the decision to commit military forces, not so much forces from Iran, but forces from other Shia countries that the Iranians organized and paid to fight in Syria to protect Assad. Now the Iranians have a very strong hold in Damascus because of their role in the civil war. To some extent, the Israelis have been successful in limiting Iran's position in Syria through direct military force. And the Iranians, as I said earlier, they're very, very cautious. So last May it was, I was in Israel at the time, there was a big attack that took place. The Israelis launched a very comprehensive attack on a number of military installations in Syria, which the Iranians were using. And it was a very overwhelming, victory. And since then, the Iranians have been very careful about keeping their forces and forces close to them away from what they think is Israel's red line. So the Iranians have a strong position in Damascus, but I think they recognize that they're not going to be able to have permanent, military bases in Syria that could threaten Israel, in part because the Russians were perfectly, didn't do anything to stop the Israelis. They looked the other way and turned their radars off, and the Israeli Air Force had a free hand. And then, of course, in Yemen, the Iranians have taken advantage of that civil war to support the Houthis, mainly as a way to, punish the Saudis and to drive the Saudis crazy. Because for Riyadh, having an Iranian presence on the Arabian Peninsula is an intolerable threat. And that explains the decision by Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince, to launch the Saudi attack on Yemen. I think, the Khashoggi affair, when I first heard about it, I was so depressed because in some ways Mohammed bin Salman is an attractive figure. At least he talks about economic and social reform in Saudi Arabia, which is very appealing. Not political reform, of course, but it talks about changes in Saudi society, and economy that's appealing. But he's proven himself to be a pretty reckless and rash leader in terms of foreign policy, not only the intervention in Yemen, but, kidnapping the Lebanese prime minister and holding him in Riyadh was a pretty outrageous thing, and his feud with Qatar, and now the Khashoggi assassination, I think really has tarnished his reputation as somebody who we can rely on. But I think the Trump administration is trying to do two things at once. First, they're trying to bury the Khashoggi issue as quickly as they can by accepting whatever cover story the Saudis put forward, no matter how flimsy it is. But secondly, I think they're trying to take advantage of the Khashoggi affair to pressure the Saudis to agree to end the Yemen conflict and perhaps the feud with Qatar as well. Whether that will be successful, I don't know, because we, as I said when I talked about Iran, we continue to rely on Saudi Arabia to overproduce oil so that we can pressure Iran's oil customers to stop buying oil from Iran. So there's a limit to how far we can push the Saudis on issues like Yemen, before they will stop cooperating on issues like Iran. So just to finish on Iran and the region, I think Iran is now, their regional policy is really one of consolidation. They've established a very strong position in Baghdad, very strong position in Damascus, always had a strong position in Lebanon, in Beirut, because of their ties with Hezbollah, And I think what they want to do is just hang on to what they have achieved. I don't think there are many new opportunities for the Iranians to expand influence, because the other countries in the region are really not susceptible. They're too powerful, like Turkey or Egypt or Israel or Saudi. So I think the Iranian influence in the region has probably reached a high water mark at this point.
Now, just one more question on Iran, and it'll transition us into talking about North Korea. With North Korea, the U.S., Trump, moved from bullying to sweet talk to a summit. Can we imagine such a changed approach in Iran, moving to sweet talking and summits?
I genuinely believe, as I said, that Trump thinks he's pursuing a diplomatic strategy with Iran that starts with insults and intimidation and ends with summits and a deal. I think that he is trying to apply that model to Iran, as he's applied to North Korea successfully. But I don't think the Iranians are receptive. And I think in part, as I said, it's cultural. In part, it's because they just don't think the Trump administration is serious about negotiating a deal that Iran would find acceptable. And I hear rumors that there have been some secret talks, which is the normal way the Iranians would pursue this kind of thing. And for now, I think they've decided their course of action is to boycott any negotiations with the Trump administration, at least until 2020. What happens after that will depend on the outcome of the U.S. elections. If Trump is reelected, the Iranians may decide that, you know, rather than continue to suffer, from economic sanctions, they may try to reach some kind of accommodation with the Trump administration, which, as I say, you won't know about it because it'll all take place in the shadows. There'll be secret talks just like there was with Obama before it all became public. Or the Iranians might decide to leave the nuclear deal if they calculate that they can revive their nuclear program without running the risk of an attack from Israel or the U.S., they may decide to do that. If there's a different president than Trump, I'm confident the Iranians will try to negotiate a new version of the JCPOA. It won't be the same because the Iranians will want compensation for all the economic damage they've suffered under the Trump administration. And my guess is that a new U.S. administration, even if it's democratic, will want to improve the terms of the deal, especially the sunset clauses. Because as we get closer and closer to those limits on Iran's nuclear program being lifted, then we're going to confront the same problem we had in 2015. And I'm willing to bet that a new Democratic president would seek to at least extend those sunset clauses.
Let me then move to North Korea. And you've been commenting throughout, but let me focus some questions on North Korea. When I read through the summit document, I didn't see any new language in there that I hadn't seen three or four times before in previous agreements. Have you seen anything new coming out of from the North Koreans in terms of promises or than they made in past agreements?
No. And in fact, the language of the Singapore summit was even worse, was even more evasive and conditional than earlier language that the North Koreans have agreed to in previous negotiations. But I heard that President Trump, he didn't really care what the communique said. I mean, normally in these kinds of summit meetings, the staff fights over every little word and comma, and you don't know you're getting close to agreement until you're arguing about punctuation, right? Then you know that you're almost, almost close to a deal. But in this case, I'm told, the American, diplomats who were negotiating the Singapore summit communique, they were fighting for the usual tough language we like on denuclearization, and the North Koreans said no, and at the end of the day, Trump said, I don't care, that's not important to me. What matters to me is, meeting and befriending Kim Jong-un. That's what counts. So I think Trump, because he's such an unusual president, he doesn't keep score the way normal, presidents do in diplomacy. And I think that's the reason why you got such a weak communique by any normal standard. I didn't mind it so much because even in the past, when we got good, clean, strong language out of the North Koreans, they violated it. So to me, it doesn't matter much. The North Koreans are not to be trusted no matter what the words on a piece of paper say.
Then here's one on South Korea and how it plays into all this. How does South Korea factor into this? Are they on a steady path to reconciliation?
So I think South Korea is incredibly important, mainly because they control the biggest economic carrot we have. I mean, the new South Korean president, Moon Jae-in, comes from, you know, the Progressive Party in South Korea. And the Progressive Party has a strategy toward North Korea which is basically built around engagement, with, and in particular, economic investment, trade, which they believe will ultimately lead to a gradual transformation of the North Korean regime and even create conditions for unification. The other party in South Korea, the conservatives, their policy's always been tough love, to punish North Korea through economic sanctions and try to destroy the regime through economic damage. The progressives, it's warm love approach, right? To you, they call it the sunshine policy, that you want to embrace the North Koreans as a way to bring about change. So we, if the Trump administration uses it cleverly, I think we have some pretty big economic carrots to offer North Korea in exchange for verified constraints on their nuclear program. And the one I mentioned over and over again is a cap on further production of nuclear weapons, which at least will make the threat we face more manageable. It doesn't lead immediately to zero, but it would make it it would cap the size of North Korea's nuclear threat at its current arsenal, whatever it is. We don't know, of course, what it is. The South Koreans are, Moon Jae-in sees himself as basically trying to mediate between Trump and Kim Jong-un. And when I talk to the South Koreans, they're quite concerned because they think the process since the Singapore meeting has really, you know, run into some very significant obstacles, as I mentioned in my speech. And they're pushing very hard for a second Trump-Kim summit for the same reason Kim Jong-un is, because the South Koreans believe Trump is much more flexible than the rest of the U.S. government when it comes to making concessions to North Korea. And I think the South Koreans are concerned that either Trump will be convinced by his advisors, by Bolton and Mattis and Pompeo, not to be so generous toward North Korea, or if President Trump is not reelected, the new U.S. administration will, you know, revert to a more typical U.S. approach toward North Korea, and, you know, whatever opportunity there is for rapid progress on North-South relations will evaporate. And the big nightmare in Seoul is that Kim Jong-un will at some point become so frustrated and impatient that he'll resume nuclear testing and Trump will resume threats of bloody nose, and the South Koreans were genuinely terrified that President Trump might launch a military attack without their support last year before Trump shifted to a diplomatic approach.
So do we have direct influence over what the South Koreans do and the Japanese in the area?
So, in terms of the South Koreans, as I said, their political system is divided between conservatives and progressives. And I think Moon has to be careful not to act in a way that leads to an open break with the United States, because that would be unpopular in South Korea. The alliance with the U.S. is, by many, not all South Koreans, is still seen as an important anchor for their security against the threat from North Korea. So I think that we do have a lot of influence. And so far, anyway, when the South Koreans have looked for ways to advance with the North without fully consulting with the U.S. or without support from Washington, they have really, they've really retreated when Washington has raised objections. And recently, a working group was set up between the U.S. and the ROK to better coordinate. So anytime two governments set up a committee to better coordinate, you know that there's a problem. And apparently, I'm told that the South Koreans agreed to some military measures with North Korea that our forces in South Korea didn't like very much, like taking some mines out of certain areas of the demilitarized zone and stopping surveillance drones from flying in the area. And our military felt that they weren't fully consulted and that these measures could potentially jeopardize military readiness. So we've objected, and now this new committee has been set up. In the case of the Japanese, their big fear is that Trump will make a deal with North Korea that essentially accepts North Korean constraints on long-range missiles that could threaten the United States and doesn't do anything about the missiles that can threaten Japan. So the big Japanese fear is that the U.S. will not be a good ally and will only care about our own national security and, you know, will be prepared to have the Japanese continue to be vulnerable to North Korean missiles. And, you know, all of President Trump's rhetoric about America first and how allies are not paying their fair share and we shouldn't be protecting them anyway, all of that, of course, feeds, Japanese fears that the U.S. will leave them in the lurch.
Then let's talk a little bit about China and Russia in this context. Do China and Russia act as partners in this, or rivals, or a mix of the two, or what's the situation with?
So the first thing to say is that in terms of relative importance on the North Korea issue, China is many times more important than Russia. Russia is a marginal player and has been a marginal player since the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of massive Soviet subsidies and arms sales to North Korea. So China is a much more important player. And I would say, by and large, they act as partners. There's a little bit of Chinese suspicion when the Russians try to increase their diplomatic influence or their economic role in North Korea. But for the most part, they act together in the forums that count, like at the UN, or if there's a multilateral, you know, diplomatic forum like the six-party talks. For the most part, they coordinate their policies pretty closely. And the fact that both countries have bad relations with the United States, of course, makes it easier for them to coordinate on the North Korea issue. In the case of China, I think the Trump administration did a very good job in its first year working with China to increase UN sanctions at a time when North Korea was genuinely alienating Beijing with carrying out missile and nuclear tests that the Chinese opposed. And the U.S. capitalized on that Chinese position to put in place some very impressive UN Security Council sanctions against North Korea. But unfortunately, that partnership has really evaporated now, partly because Trump acted in Singapore without really talking to the Chinese, so they felt that there wasn't really a coordinated strategy, and partly because of the trade war, of course. The Chinese felt that they were working with the U.S. in the first year of the Trump administration, and, I mean, they were doing it in their own national interests, but they believed that that would, the fact that they were cooperating and being supportive of U.S. strategy toward North Korea would mitigate the, you know, economic tensions between Washington and Beijing. But once Trump had the Singapore meeting and thought the North Korea problem was solved, he switched to a very confrontational approach toward China on trade issues, as you're all familiar with. And I think the Chinese motive for cooperating with the United States on North Korea has been very drastically reduced. And according to what I hear, the Chinese, they're still, at least on paper, enforcing the strict letter of the UN Security Council resolutions. But everything that's ambiguous and nothing that's covered by the resolutions, the Chinese government is encouraging their businessmen to, you know, resume activities in North Korea. So the tourism trade, which was a very significant for North Korea's economy, and that was cut off at one point. Now I'm told the Chinese tourists are free and encouraged to go to North Korea and spend their yuan in Pyongyang.
Assume that you're going to be a advisor to the next administration in these areas, which you may well be if the Democrats win. What approaches would you be recommending to make real progress in these areas?
So the first thing to say is I want, and I think you know from my speech, these are not problems we're going to solve, right? These are endemic, you know, deeply embedded problems that the last six administrations have not solved. So don't expect to have a final solution, at least as long as the current governments are in place in Pyongyang and Tehran. The best we can do is manage, you know, delay, contain, prevent use. I mean, so we're really in the business of second-order solutions rather than fundamental solutions. as I suggested in the case of North Korea, I think the administration has maneuvered itself in a position where it might be able to use its bargaining leverage to get some additional limits on North Korea's nuclear and missile program beyond the test freeze. I think the test freeze is good, but it's easily reversed. And I would feel better if we could at least constrain the production of nuclear, production of additional nuclear weapons and missiles. So I would focus on an interim step which at least constrains the size of the threat. And in order to get that, you're going to have to pay for it. And that means you're going to have to use some sanctions relief, some economic offers from South Korea, and we'd have to coordinate, obviously, all of that with mainly with Seoul and with Beijing to make it effective. I don't know that it would work, but it seems to me if we continue to take a position that North Korea has to give up everything before they get anything, that's a guarantee for no progress. And I think a little bit of a risk that at some point Kim Jong-un will back out of the current constraint and will be back in a situation of high tension. In the case of Iran, I mean, the Trump administration, I think, made a fundamental mistake leaving the agreement in the first place rather than working with the Europeans who had said, we recognize this is not a perfect agreement, we accept that there are some flaws, we're willing to work with you to try to address those flaws. That would have been a much smarter approach. But now that we've left the deal, as I said, I don't think there's any way back for the rest of the Trump administration. If a new administration takes office, I think it's worth trying to salvage the agreement, but I think it's going to be a very, very tough negotiation. And in order to be effective, we're going to have to get the other parties on our side, because that's what the reason why the Iranians made concessions in the first place in 2015 is because the U.S. had built a very strong coalition with the Europeans and even the Russians and the Chinese. And when the Iranians feel isolated against a unified front from the other big powers, they'll make concessions. So we're going to have to reconstruct a working relationship with the Europeans and Russia and China if we want to have an effective diplomatic strategy toward Iran. And obviously that's something that President Trump has not been effective in his diplomacy in terms of maintaining alliances and working with adversaries like Russia and China. And it remains to be seen in the next 2 years whether he can restore some of that.
Thank you very much, Gary. Thank you.